Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to the show. Tonight I'm talking with Seth Breedlove about his new documentary, The Boggy Creek Monster. And I asked Joshua Cutchin to join me on this one because he loves to talk cryptids and is a big fan of Seth's, so seemed like a perfect match. Now for patrons, Seth has offered to give you a couple of days where you can view his movie for free. So that's going to be sent out to the patron feed, probably like Monday or Tuesday type of thing. So you'll have a couple days to watch it if you want, and I highly recommend checking it out and checking out his first two, The Minerva Monster and The Beast of Whitehall. And you can find all of that stuff at smalltownmonsters.com. Around the time of this show's fourth anniversary, which is the end of January, hopefully shortly before then or around then, we're going to have an announcement of some stuff that's going to be happening. Some really cool stuff. I think you're going to like it. All right. With no further ado, here's my conversation with Joshua Cutchin and Seth Breedlove. All right. And I'm here with Seth Breedlove and Joshua Cutchin. And we'll be talking tonight with Seth about his new documentary, The Boggy Creek Monster. How you doing tonight, Seth?
I am great. How are you guys?
All right. And I brought Joshua on because Joshua loves to talk cryptids, is a fan of yours, and this gives him that opportunity.
Yeah, I appreciate being brought into the fold. I haven't had a chance to talk to Seth yet, and as a follower both of his work and, you know, the Sass What podcast, which he's been one of the guiding forces on in the past couple of years, it's a special moment for me. So thanks for coming on, Seth.
Yeah, this is always one of my favorite shows. Like we were on here like last year, and afterward, I think I even messaged you about it. But it's just, it's a laid back kind of chill, fun show, which is refreshing.
Good. Yes, I think you did. It's been almost exactly a year. I think you were on in January of 2016. I think
I didn't even do that on purpose. So that's just synchronicity or something.
And this is your third movie.
This is the third, yeah.
Okay, and this one, you have Lyle Blackburn doing the narration and interviewing people on screen and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Lyle had come to me with the story for this way back when we were working on Minerva Monster. He came to me and mentioned possibly at some point, and I think it was actually during the taping of a Sasquatch episode, he actually had mentioned to me that he would like to work with me on a movie. And I had put it on the back burner because originally it was going to be, we were going to do Minerva Monster and then we were going to do Momo. But, what ended up happening was we did Minerva and then we did Whitehall, and Whitehall was kind of the lead in to Boggy Creek. I really wanted to get to Boggy Creek because at the time Smokey was still alive and I really wanted to talk to Smokey Crabtree and, have him involved in the story and all that. So, but that was like the whole movie, Boggy Creek was like this tightrope to walk because Lyle didn't come to me and say, hey, I want to do a movie about Boggy Creek and I want to be in it and I want to narrate it and I want to be, I want to be a focal point of the story. He didn't say that at all. Like, he basically just wanted to entrust us, Small Town Monsters, with creating a Boggy Creek movie. And so I was the guy that came up with the idea of, like, let's stick Lyle in the movie and have him narrate it. And I think it was a lot more involvement than originally he had anticipated, but he was into it, so it was cool. It was like storytelling-wise, it was a tightrope.
Well, I mean, it's a tougher nut to crack than Minerva and Whitehall because there is this body of lore and popular culture stuff around Boggy Creek that you sort of have to find your way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it does a good job of that.
It's a mountain of eyewitness stories. And whereas with like Minerva, you know, I mean, with Minerva, we could have focused on way more than just like the Caton sighting. I mean, we could have focused on sightings all around Minerva, and that would kind of encompass everything. That would encompass Salt Fork and all that stuff. So, but you know, we ended up just focusing on the Caton story, and then with Whitehall, you know, it was we spent $250 to make Beast of Whitehall. I mean, it was made for relatively nothing, and so we were limited in what we could actually accomplish in the, you know, 2 or 3 days that we used up to film that movie. So we kind of focused on the Gosselin story and the Abear incident, and with Boggy, we knew we wanted much more than, you know, like the Ford incident or something like that. We wanted it to be kind of all encompassing, and then so to do that, it made sense to have Lyle be the storyteller and the guy who's kind of taking you through that history. And if you're going to do that, you have to have some sort of heart to the story, and to, you know, to actually bring in the fact that Lyle's been connected to this since he was a kid. And you know, I think it all ties together, and honestly, it ties into the original Legend of Boggy Creek as well, because if you I snuck some like Easter eggs into the narration and stuff like that, regarding Lyle talking about how when he was a kid, you know, he grew up aware of that story. The movie, our movie, bookends much the same way that the Legend of Boggy Creek did. It opens with a boy, and it closes with a boy who's now a man, and that's kind of how our movie does. And so, yeah. It was a lot of fun. It was a ton of work too, though, because I did, you know, I wrote all the narration, and then I was also editing the whole movie by myself on a Dell laptop that did not do very well with a feature length film that was full of effects.
Huh. Well, you can't tell by watching it, because it turned out beautiful.
It's every one of our movies has issues, and it's always like technical stuff that is just I cannot overcome. And in this one, there were audio issues, and we're not even done with the movie in a way, because I'm still trying to like iron out some of the kinks. And we want to do a kind of a director's cut of Boggy Creek. I've got at least another 15 minutes I'd like to add into the movie, maybe next year, and put out like a, you know, a remastered kind of fix up the audio track a little bit more and stuff like that. So, but yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, and I said this off air, but just to reiterate, everyone, I can't recommend the Small Town Monster series enough. This is, it's not to disparage the earlier entries in the series, but this has a level of polish and professionalism, and it's gorgeous that the earlier entries just didn't have. So this is definitely, things are definitely progressing in the right direction, and the seams don't show nearly as much as they once did. So kudos to you on that.
That's the whole thing with making these, is like trying to hide the fact that we are the biggest bunch of amateurs, like especially me. Honestly, everyone else that works on these is probably much more talented than I am. I just kind of like bumble along and hope we can find ways to hide the fact that I have no idea what I'm doing.
Well, you succeed, and they've definitely gotten, you know, each one, as Joshua said, each one looks better than the previous one by a significant amount, and that's obviously what you're going for.
Yeah, and to change, we're also like, there's a conscious effort at this point to change the look of each one, you know, like Beast of Whitehall, I went into it wanted to make it look like an old police procedural from the 70s. So it's got this like handheld thing going on, and some of that was also the constraints of budget and the fact that we were trying to shoot on the run. So like we'd pull up at a place and I'd leap out of the car with a shoulder rig and a camera mounted on it, and that shoot my B-roll that way. But like that movie was intentionally in some ways made to look the way it did, because we wanted it to look like a police procedural from the 70s. Like, yeah, I always think of like Dragnet, but with Boggy, we wanted it to harken back to the 1970s. So you've got like all these film blots going on throughout the movie, and you know, different little color things we did. And then with the Mothman movie we're working on right now, the tone we're going for is much more like somber than our other movies. And it's much more filmic. We're shooting with this old digital Bolex camera. it's not old, but it's kind of intentionally made to look like an older style camera. So it's not going to look like super flashy or anything, but I think the tone of Mothman is going to be light years apart from Boggy. But yeah, that part of that too is the equipment we're using. You know, we're able to use all this. We were able to actually rent gimbals and, you know, professional cinema cameras and stuff like that for Boggy. So it was another level. I don't know. I hope at some point, you know, we can get together that much money again to put into gear. But at the same time, it's one of those things where I don't necessarily think you need it. It just kind of depends on what the project calls for. And Boggy was something where, you know, we knew we wanted to get footage of the river, and you want to go down the river and get footage on the river, and to do all that stuff, you got to have decent gear that can handle it. So everything varies project to project.
And a lot of great art is made great by the restrictions that are put on it. You know, restriction breeds creativity. So I think working within those parameters, you certainly can't, well, I don't want to make this into the, I love Seth's show, but I think working within those parameters actually in some ways sort of has helped your productions in general.
That's awesome, though. I mean, you can make it into the I Love Seth show, because that'd be fun.
why don't you tell people a little bit of the history of Boggy, the Boggy Creek Monster?
Yeah, well, the story became famous back in 1973, that the Falk Monster was this creature that had been seen down in the bottomlands of southern Arkansas for decades prior to the 70s. But kind of in 1973, Charles Pierce showed up. Charles Pierce was this B-movie director. He showed up in Falk, Arkansas, and he made a pseudo-documentary. They call it a what did they call it? I just totally blanked. It's like a mockumentary, but it's a docudrama. I think that's what they call it.
So yeah, that sounds right.
It's made to be like a, it feels like a documentary, but it's not. So
because it's sort of like a docudrama, but there's real people involved. It's not straight. Like, you normally, when you think of a docudrama, it's all reenactments, and where there are reenactments, you know, as you point out in the film, like there are real witnesses, and there's some stuff that's very, very genuine.
I honestly, I kind of think it's just a documentary by today's standards, because like while he did fictionalize some of the accounts, they were still based on real, you know, like there's a couple scenes in the movie that are basically an amalgamation of like three or four different sightings. But I mean, movies are made all the time now where they do that same thing and they still get called documentaries. So in a lot of ways, you're right. Like it's almost a documentary more so than a docudrama or a mockumentary. But anyway, he made this movie about the Falk Monster, and his story kind of focused on three or four different kind of major encounters, and then I don't know, there was, you know, some other ancillary sightings that were kind of tossed in there as well. And I don't know, at some point the movie came out and just became this enormous kind of juggernaut at the box office. And I say that I've been told I'm exaggerating the success of The Legend of Boggy Creek, but if you look at a movie making $20+ million in 1970s money, that's early 1970s money. That is a boatload of money. Like it's kind of difficult to overstate the success of The Legend of Boggy Creek, especially when you consider he made that movie for $100,000. So the return on investment in that is, you know, Blair Witch levels. So anyway, the movie came out, and for most people, it died off at that point. That's where The Legend of Boggy Creek ended. But Lyle Blackburn showed up in Falk a few years ago and started investigating the Falk Monster, and came to find out that the sightings didn't start back in the 70s, and they didn't stop in the 70s, and they've gone on all the way up till today. And he started documenting those stories. So our movie kind of focuses on Lyle's involvement in that story. So you're seeing the whole history of the Falk Monster through Lyle's eyes, but it's condensed into a, you know, a 75-minute movie. So it's like over a century's worth of sightings kind of condensed into this movie. That's the movie in a nutshell, if that was good enough.
What do the creature usually get described as?
I mean, it's your standard kind of Bigfoot. It's like the difference here, or at least the difference that we try to see, I don't know how much of that is real. You know, like, so typically people talk about the Southern Sasquatch, like the, you know, this like lean and mean kind of Bigfoot creature. But when, you know, when I look at the sighting reports for the Falk monster, it doesn't seem like they're all that different from like the PNW Bigfoot or the Ohio Bigfoot. You know, they're it's all pretty much a creature who likes to stay to its, you know, its protected habitat and steer clear of mankind, and it seems kind of curious, and occasionally it gets pissed off at people and screams. So
like we all do.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically me on any weekday morning.
Okay. So the descriptions throughout the history of it have been pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things you note that's kind of odd is that some of the footprints that have been casted only have three toes and are fairly narrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is one of those topics that in Falk is dangerous. You got to like watch what you say. But I mean, for my money, those tracks were more than likely a hoax, or they were an alligator, because I mean, it doesn't make sense for that to be. If you look at the tracks, those three toe tracks, they really do look just like an alligator track to me, or something totally fake. I've seen two different versions. Actually, I've seen three different versions. I've seen a version that you can pretty much tell is just an alligator. And then I've seen a version that very much looks like kind of that. I don't know if you've ever seen the Honey Island Swamp Monster cast, but that was pretty much proven to be a hoax track when they found that there was some, I don't know. I'm not saying that all the Honey Island Monster tracks were hoaxed, but they found, you know, the foot, the shoe that guy actually used to make those tracks. It kind of reminded me of those. And then what we kind of unveiled in our movie is that the casts actually taken at the soybean field do look like they have five toes, not three toes. The kind of, I guess what made people think it was a three-toed cast is that the last two digits are kind of hidden, like they're not pressed as deeply into the soil. So you know, for a lot of people that became the three-toed cast. But if you actually see one of those track casts in person, it's pretty clear that there's five toes there, but they are weird, you know, like oddly narrow for a Bigfoot cast. When you see Bigfoot cast, they're usually extremely wide. That's part of the, you know, whole mythology of Bigfoot. Mythology is the totally wrong word. Someone's going to sue me. I'm going to have a Bigfoot fan.
Not this listenership, I don't think.
But you know what I mean. Like in Bigfoot
lore.
In Bigfoot lore, they have, I don't know that that's any better, but they're supposedly like these really wide casts, and that's not necessarily what I saw coming out of the soybean field down there. So I don't know. It's you know, it's possible that it was a younger one. It wasn't insanely long. The cast I saw, I forget the exact length. I think we say in the movie, but it wasn't like 22 inches long or anything like that. It was long enough, you know, probably 14, 15 inches, something like that. And then it was fairly narrow for a Bigfoot cast. So I don't know.
Okay. Now, people have been injured by this creature.
Yes. Yeah. Their pride, so there's a couple instances where the thing kind of, you know, terrified people. Like if you're referring, are you referring kind of to the Ford incident?
Yeah.
Is that, yeah.
Where they had to take him to the hospital or whatever?
Yeah, mostly that was from he fell through a door. He was so terrified. He was like running from the creature, and he he kind of fell through a door, put his whole hand through a glass window, and then he passed out from shock. So when they took him to the hospital, it was because he was so terrified. And then I guess he was bleeding all over the place. So, but yeah, you're not wrong though, because like, I guess the idea of the creature being this kind of mean, you know, a more angry version of a Bigfoot comes from like the Lynn Crabtree sighting, which is this creature walking up on this little kid who shoots it, you know, multiple times in the face, according to him. And yet it, you know, never was injured, and it walked right up to him and screams in his face. And, you know, so I think some of it comes from that. And then, just the general feeling some people get that this thing wants to mess you up. And it's terrifying enough if you think about the, like, what the reality of seeing one of these creatures out in the wild would be like. And then if you throw in the fact that it might rip your arms off and beat you to death with your own fist, I guess that's probably, it probably just adds to the whole thing.
The shooting it incident is kind of interesting, because it didn't seem to even be bothered by the fact that it was being shot, which to me suggests that maybe it's not as simple as just a flesh and blood creature. It reminds me of the, help me out here, Joshua, the case where they were shooting the aliens coming and they would do like backflips and then...
Oh, sort of the Kelly Hopkinsville
guy. That's
ones.
It, Hopkinsville, yeah. Where they were just pretty much immune to gunfire.
Yeah, and this is not, I mean, Lynn's sighting isn't the only sighting I've heard of the Falk monster where someone shot at it and claimed that it never fell or, you know, even seemed to get hit. So, and you know, of course, he was, if I remember right, Lynn had a squirrel shot. So, I mean, it wouldn't have been incredibly powerful regardless, but you would expect shooting anything in the face that it would at least... you know, turn and run or turn and walk away. And this thing just kind of came right up to him. So here's the thing though. The Boggy Creek story is like one of the few that I've investigated where I do not see a through line for like the paranormal. I just don't, like, for the most part, there aren't, you know, strange lights in the sky reports. There aren't things like that. With Beast of Whitehall, there was a UFO flap that took place, you know, at the same time as the Abrey Road incident. And with Minerva, the Catons claim to see UFOs and ghosts and all sorts of stuff on the property. And with Boggy Creek, in all the reports we took down there, you know, and we talked to 12 different sighting witnesses just in the few days I was there, and I've spoken to people nearly every single time I've gone down since, I haven't heard a single high strangeness kind of vibe from any of those stories, and it's one of the only ones that I've seen where that's the case.
Well, if you look at like sort of the, at least in the case of the small town monsters cases, it's one of the few, the Boggy Creek monster is one of the few incidents that doesn't seem to occur in what you would normally, you know, consider like a Keelian window area. I mean, you have the you know, with Minerva, you mentioned there was the anomalous alien big cat sightings at the same time, sometimes mm-hmm. seen in conjunction with the monster. And also, you know, did you mention the Whitehall, the UFO incidents in Whitehall in that documentary? It's been so long since I've seen it. I can't recall.
It's mentioned in passing, and we show one of the newspaper articles, but that was one of the things that, you know, we had to leave on the cutting room floor, unfortunately.
Yeah, I feel like when people try to talk about these things, I mean, again, we're sort of going a little bit off track because, as I mentioned, Boggy Creek isn't one of those type of things. But like, to me, when people will talk about Bigfoot and don't fully engage with some of the high strangeness stuff, it's almost like talking about the North African campaign in World War II and not only talking about the Italians or only talking about the Germans. Like, you have to view it sort of in a continuum of what's happening in the area at the same time. And I think that... personally, that's sort of an axe that I've had to grind with the cryptozoological community, is that they don't always fully engage with the fact that there's some other really weird stuff that happens around these things. And that's why I'm sort of excited. I'm interested, rather, or excited and interested to see what you do with Mothman, mm-hmm. because I don't think you can get away from that, really, with that sort of narrative.
No, and I wouldn't want to, because I mean, it's one of the things that draws me to like the Mothman story. And before I got into Bigfoot, I was into UFOs. So like my whole, you know, induction into this field was kind of through ufology rather than Bigfoot stuff. So it's now just personally, like my personal opinion is still that Bigfoot is an undiscovered primate. But if the story has that kind of angle to it, I would love to explore it. There's two problems with both of those movies. With Minerva, we never actually found out about the UFO angle until after the fact. We found out about the James Shannon police investigation of the UFO landing across the street from the Caton's house.
You mean Whitehall or Minerva? Because you said Minerva.
I'm talking about Minerva right now.
Okay.
I
wasn't actually aware of the UFO angle in Minerva.
There's a big UFO angle. There was a UFO that landed across the street from the Caton's house 2 weeks after their initial police report.
Of course.
They claim they've seen UFOs on their property and all sorts of other unusual kind of incidents. But that was the case with Minerva. It was just we weren't able to like investigate that side of the story because it came after the fact. Like we had already shot the movie. And then with Whitehall, it was intended to be a short film. And the only person I could find to really talk about the UFO angle was Paul Bartholomew. And it just felt odd to have Paul just kind of droning on for 5 minutes about UFOs in the middle of the movie. You know, so, but that's something, actually, I was just talking beforehand, like at some point I would love to revisit that whole area of upstate New York and Vermont and maybe do something about like that Bennington Triangle area. And part of that is just like my desire to work with Paul Bartholomew again, because I really like that guy. Like his take on this stuff is kind of refreshingly open-minded without being so open-minded his brain fell out.
Well, that's interesting to me, especially in the cases of Minerva and Boggy Creek. There seem to be these things tend to center around families in almost a Hound of the Baskervilles type manner, you know, with the way that the Crabtrees were so involved in the family and Minerva. And that to me is also sort of indicative that there might be something else going on. I mean, like, honestly, you have to work from a place of established strength when you're dealing with these things. You can't jump in and say that it is, you know, super weird. You have to sort of work from the working angle that there are, you know, there's a historical fossil record precedent for these sort of things. But that's really interesting. I wasn't aware of the Minerva phenomena, and you know, it's another interesting facet in that case for sure.
Yeah, it's weird, and it gets weirder the longer I'm kind of involved in that story, the more I'm finding out about it. It's like a rabbit hole with the Minerva monster. So,
I was just gonna say, there's another dimension is that you can't the Bigfoot community is not really receptive to this sort of talk. That's the other facet that you have to sort of navigate your way around too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I don't know, I'm a storyteller and a filmmaker, you know, before I never have said I was a Bigfooter. I don't consider myself a Bigfooter. I don't really go out in the woods and look for Bigfoot. I go on hikes and I go camping and all that kind of stuff. But I don't typically go out, you know, trying to have an experience. If I'm out in the woods, it's to get my brain off of this kind of stuff, actually. But but you know, like if that's a part of the story, you know, like I want that to be in the film. Unfortunately, with the first two, it didn't pan out because it was one of those cases. In both cases, there was a reason why it didn't work out. But there's one story in particular I really want to hit in the next year, hopefully, and it's got kind of all of that stuff. It's got UFOs and dog eating Bigfoots and all kinds of stuff.
Well, you know, you have to juggle running time and tone and all that and everything. I'm sorry, Sarai, I'll let you.
No, it's fine. That's why you're here, Josh.
But you know, that is one of the things that people don't realize, is that when you're doing something like this, you can only get your arms around so much, and you have to sort of juggle. I mean, tone is a big thing. Mm-hmm. In filmmaking, and to have somebody, as you mentioned with Bartholomew, just drone on about UFOs plopped in the middle, that can kill pacing. It can kill a lot of things.
Yeah, and I mean, people, for whatever reason, Whitehall's our most viewed movie by by thousands. I mean, it's been viewed by over 100,000 people now. So I don't know if that is because of the length. You know, it's a short film. I don't know if it's that, if that's more inviting to people, or what it is. But that movie's done far better than I ever could have expected it to. So, and a lot of that has to do with, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we kept the runtime short. Which at the same time, you know, like I can't really brag about the fact that we kept the runtime short because we did that because I didn't have the money to make a feature-length film about the Whitehall incident.
Okay. Well, and of course, since you mentioned it, do you want to talk about the briefly what you're looking at that eats dogs?
I've talked. Yeah, the Momo movie is what I really want to do. You know, hopefully after Mothman. Now, that's not a guarantee. There's a lot of variables with each one of these stories, and working too far out in advance, you can shoot yourself in the foot, you know, because, sure, like, there's just so many variables at play, because you can lose witnesses and people pass away or they move or they don't want to talk about it when you go to film the movie. So right now I'm saying that's what I'd like to do after Mothman, and it kind of fits within this, like, the first three movies we did, the box set is called Volume 1 Bigfoot, and I kind of wanted Volume 2 to be called High Strangeness. So that's, you know, like, I think the Momo story kind of fits within, you know, the parameters of that. It's got strange lights in the sky and stuff like that. But yeah, that's what eats dogs. Although Big Muddy Monster in Illinois supposedly ate dogs too. So, and obviously the Minerva Monster ripped a dog's neck apart or whatever, broke a dog's neck. So they don't like dogs, which is a problem for me because I've got two.
So going back to the flesh and blood thing, if you're finding all these paranormal elements around these other two cases, why do you think there are Bigfoot sightings associated with them if they are flesh and blood creatures?
See, my problem with the other elements to the stories is the same as, like, my problem with Bigfoot, which is that I haven't been able to corroborate any of it. You know, like, So when I hear a story like James Shannon, who is the sheriff in Stark County, who actually investigated the Minerva Monster sighting, he told me he only ever investigated two unusual incident reports. He only ever got called for two paranormal related reports. One of them was Minerva Monster, and the other was that UFO landing, and they both happened directly across the street from each other. So that obviously is going to set off bells in my head that, hey, maybe those two were connected and things like that. But at the same time, I don't know what went on in the field that night. I don't know, you know, like, it's the same thing I have with the Bigfoot stories. I just don't know, you know, like, for myself, I need to answer the whether or not Bigfoot exists. I'd like to know whether or not UFOs exist. There's like two Seths at work here, because, like, there's the Seth who's just making movies, you know, like, who wants to tell a great story and wants to be truthful and honest, and, you know, like, put all the documentarian pieces of the puzzle together. And then there's the Seth who still is into these subjects. It would, you know, I'd still be into Bigfoot or UFOs or the paranormal whether or not I was making movies about this stuff, you know. And that Seth just wants to know the truth behind everything. So, that's what I mean. There's like the filmmaker side of me who's doing this and doesn't get to be as involved in the stories and kind of learning or investigating them as I'd like to. And then there's the Seth who is John Keel. not comparing myself to John Keel, but you know, but what I mean? Like, who's trying to dig into the stuff, the truth behind it.
See, between Small Town Monsters and Sasquatch, I would have never really suspected that there was this side of you. Like, I feel like this side of you is sort of taken a backseat to a more flesh and blood. No, there's anything wrong with the flesh and blood hypothesis. Like, I'm open to the idea that there are multiple things going on. I think that the flesh and blood thing is definitely in a lot of ways, it's the most useful avenue of speculation, but at the same time, I think it's limiting. But just judging you from your work, I would have never guessed that there was this sort of extra, you know, additional facet to you. So it's interesting to hear.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, again, like, that's still my working hypothesis is the flesh and blood angle, but I'm not the type of person to close down, you know, on a, on another angle to a story either. And some of that just has to do with the fact that I grew up, you know, I was a newspaper reporter for 8 years. So you learn to come at things objectively. And so I think that's kind of the approach I take to the whole Bigfoot phenomenon in general, is just, you know, be objective and figure out what the truth behind the whole thing is.
Yeah, and it's interesting the Boggy Creek doesn't have any of that paranormal stuff. I remember talking to Lyle Blackburn about it a few years ago.
Yeah.
And he's like, nope. I mean, he obviously believes that these things are flesh and blood monsters, but, you know, it didn't seem like he was just avoiding it. He's like, no, I've never had a single, you know, single person tell me anything other than the Boggy Creek monster weird happened in their life.
Yeah, no, it's bizarre. It's almost more bizarre to me because I've done these other movies where, you know, between Mothman and Minerva in Whitehall, they all have a UFO angle or you know, some sort of high strangeness angle to the story. And even in the Minerva Monster movie, you know, we included the phantom cats and all that stuff. But yeah, it's bizarre in a way to me that Boggy doesn't. Because there's witnesses everywhere down there. I can't overstate that enough. You cannot walk into the Monster Mart without someone coming up to you and telling you about their Bigfoot encounter. But I have not heard a single story about, you know, strange lights in the sky or anything like that connected with a sighting.
But, you know, if I draw another parallel to, like, sort of, you know, the UFO researcher angle, people who are interested in a certain narrative, and I'm not saying that Lyle is this person, I believe that these stories are genuinely finding him this way, but people who are, who become invested to a certain degree in a certain explanation, the accounts that support those tend to find them. Like, you look at the way that David Jacobs is all about hybrids and this nuts and bolts ETH thing, and you look at the way that some other people like, who are more open to a more esoteric spiritual angle, like I don't know, John Mack to a certain degree. These sort of stories found them. And so I wonder if there isn't some degree of self-selection in all these sort of esoteric topics in general, where these sort of stories, I'm not sure. I don't think it's people being disingenuous. I just think it's just somehow these people are more open to those sort of stories, and that those people seek the researchers out who are sort of more open to that particular angle.
Maybe, but down there in Falk, I don't think anybody that's coming into the Monster Mart, getting a hold of a researcher, has any clue, you know, or any kind of sense of who, or, you know, what the difference is between one researcher or another. I really don't. I think they're just Joe Blow hanging out in the swamp, you know.
And the local history of anomalous sightings in general would sort of bear that out. The fact, again, that we've been talking about, there's not this other weirdness associated with Boggy Creek.
Yeah, but it is strange that in all the sightings that I've seen down there, I haven't had a single one. And Lyle could probably correct me on that. I'm sure there's something out there, but, you know, I haven't actually spoken to anyone.
I don't know. When I asked Lyle, he said there was nothing.
Yeah. And at the same time, here I am sitting here saying, well, there were three-toed tracks, regardless of the veracity. There's glowing eyes, which people can do backflips all day that they want to about eye shine, but that's not always the case in these, you know, in these events.
Were there glowing eyes in Boggy Creek?
Oh yeah, oh yeah, okay. yeah. The red eyes comes up pretty consistently. I mean, it's not every report or anything, but a lot of the people do recount seeing, you know, eye shine. Not eye shine. It's weird with, so the glowing eyes thing, I've got my own opinion that's formulating on this glowing eyes thing. I think the term glowing red eyes is actually disingenuous, because what I'm getting from guys like Brian Gosselin, who claimed to see the creature in the field in Whitehall, New York, what he told us off the record, not off the record like he asked us to be off the record, but he told us this at breakfast one morning, was that it wasn't that the eyes glowed red, is that they were red in color. But at the same time, I say that about Brian, but if you watch the movie, Mary Beth Searcy, when she woke up in the middle of the night and saw the creature looking in her window, or no, this that wasn't Mary Beth, that would be... Ford. I cannot remember which member of the Ford family that was, but the Ford daughter or sister who woke up in the middle of the night and saw the creature looking in her windows said its eyes glowed like coals of fire. So obviously I'm talking out of my butt right now, because those two descriptions of what they were seeing do not ring true. You know, like Brian's telling us, the other thing that confused me about Brian saying that his sighting, you know, that the creature, its eyes were just red in color, that doesn't make a ton of sense when you consider the fact that he also said in the same interview that the field was so dark you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. So, I mean, he had his, it almost makes more sense for the eyes to be going red in color, because he knows that thing's coming at him. Of course, he did flash it with a spotlight, too, so maybe that's when he was talking about. But the glowing red eyes thing is always going to throw a wrench in the works for flesh and blood people like me, because it's a bizarre angle for a natural creature to have eyes that that emit some sort of, you know, interior light.
And you get it with a lot of weird monster accounts as well that are not likely to be flesh and blood creatures.
Mothman.
Yeah, a great example is Mothman, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of sort of suspecting that there are multiple things going on here, John Keel used to use that as sort of like his red flag, pardon the color pun, I guess, but his red flag that certain entities were of a more biological nature versus a more supernatural nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something had red eyes, it meant that it was more paranormal.
Right.
Is there any evidence, any physical evidence other than the footprints for the Boggy Creek Monster?
You know, we've got audio recordings from down there, and then Lyle's got some audio. We captured a little bit of audio that we put in the movie. But other than that, not really. I mean, there's no, you know, I'm sure there's some guy who has Bigfoot poop in his freezer somewhere down there. I'm not even exaggerating. I'm 100% sure there's some guy down there who has that. Because we have not done a story yet where someone hasn't come to me later and told me they have Bigfoot poop somewhere stored away.
Or what they believe to be Bigfoot poop.
Right. So I don't know. There's pretty much it's just the track cast, you know, and of course, like, people talk about stick structures and all that stuff, but that stuff's so weird and vague, and
yeah, I agree.
I don't know what to make of that stuff.
I mean, if you had a stick structure with some hair in it, and then you could take the hair and analyze it and show that it's not from a known mammal, that right. would be interesting. But if you just have a stick structure, a person can make a stick structure.
Yeah. I'd be curious to know if there were any hairs from that Boggy Creek area ever submitted to, like, Sykes' study for examination. Because I know Brian Sykes did that DNA study a couple years ago. And I know he initially had submissions from kind of all over the country. And I do know that, you know, there's people down in Falk who are out looking for Bigfoot evidence on a daily basis. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if someone has what they consider Bigfoot hair, you know, or scat. Big scat fans, Bigfooters are.
And you were saying something earlier, Joshua, and I completely cut you off about the red eyes. You were saying, you were getting into the sort of paranormal element versus the flesh and blood element.
Well, no, I was just saying that, like, you know, you do find cases, not specifically, you know, to the Falk monster, but in general, like, where every single example of glowing red eyes is attributed to eye shine. And I'm sure there's some cases where glowing eyes really are eye shine, I'm sure, you know, if especially if we're dealing with a flesh and blood creature. But at the same time, like, there are some examples, as you mentioned, Seth, where there's not any ambient light to make that happen. And even if there is, it's not directly shining into the face of the creature to create sort of a you know, an eye shine effect. And it's just, it boggles. And the things that you hear a lot of, the hoops that you hear a lot of, you know, researchers jump through, not only the eye shine thing, but some people have speculated, you know, the idea that perhaps there is some sort of like deep sea fish style phosphorescence that emits from the eyes of these creatures. And to me that almost pushes my own personal, you know,
that was disbelief. That was like a moneymaker idea too. I think Matt Moneymaker posited that they had some sort of connection to like deep sea fish and bioluminescence, and I mean, what a bunch of nonsense.
Then we're gonna adhere to the idea that this must be a relic hominid, but then we're gonna start bringing in stuff from all over the animal kingdom to explain some of its attributes. It just doesn't wash with me, you know.
Yeah. No. You get to a point where you're trying to explain something that we probably have no hope of explaining without actually finding a creature and you know, knowing how they operate. And when you get into the area where flesh and blood people are so adamantly defending our position that we are going to the point where we're trying to compare Bigfoot to a deep sea, to a deep sea fish, it becomes embarrassing.
We're through the looking glass here, you know.
Yeah.
So the I totally forgot. Oh, the cycles of these things, are there encounters? Do they come in like batches, or are they spread out pretty evenly along the time frame of what we have?
The sheriff, H.L. Phillips, he was the Miller County sheriff down in Falk, Arkansas, Texarkana. He was in that whole kind of area. He told us they took sighting reports every 3 weeks for 46 years. That's his entire time on the force. There was so it was a steady stream of reports coming into him. I'm sure there were times where there were more reports coming in. I know about a year ago there was a dry spell for a little while where there was very little. It was back when all that flooding was going on down in Falk. It seemed like all of a sudden no one was seeing Bigfoot for a little while. But you know, in talking to the sheriff, I mean the fact that there were that many reports coming in and some of the reports were so believable. I put one in the movie just because I thought it was so fascinating. It's right at the end of the movie. H.L. Phillips talks about how the last sighting report he took was from this family. Their two girls were riding their bikes down there. Mm-hmm. And the one girl got ahead of the other girl, and she couldn't figure out where the other girl had gone. And she figured the other girl had fell off her bike or something. She turns around and goes back. And the girl says, what happened? Where were you? And the other girl said, well, there was this big, hairy-looking monster that came out of the woods. And these two kids had no idea about the Falk monster. They had no idea about any of this, you know, Bigfoot stuff. They didn't know that the Legend of Boggy Creek was a movie. The family was completely oblivious. And I thought, what an awesome story, you know, like... That my two favorite, that's probably, you know, one of my favorite stories in the entire movie are those two little girls. And then the other story I love is the story that John Attaway tells about his aunt, or his great aunt, I can't remember, who was 12 years old and had a sighting when she was fishing on a creek back in the early 1900s. She came around a bend in the river and saw this creature bent over washing its feet in the water. And she had held on to that story until like her deathbed. So I thought both of those stories were really cool.
The sound you played during the film, it didn't sound that weird to me, honestly.
Yeah, I didn't do anything to boost it either. People were like, I could hardly hear it. I just the way I operate with this stuff is we had never put any kind of quote unquote evidence into one of our movies before. And mostly because I don't want it to turn into Finding Bigfoot, you know, like I don't want to insert us. I don't want to insert myself into a movie. Unless that was something that naturally happened within the story. And this was not a case where I needed to suddenly appear on camera with an audio recorder in my hand. So I didn't do anything in post to boost that. It isn't extremely out of the ordinary. What you can't quite hear, and at some point I probably should, you know, post this online or something so people can boost it for themselves and kind of, you know, play around with it. But there are some odd things at the end of that howl. It goes up and down. It almost becomes a form of the Ohio howl at one point. And the other, you know, the other really unusual thing about it was some of the other stuff that was going on down there that night. It wasn't just the howl. There were other things that had taken place down there. It was in a spot, you know, where Doyle's claimed to see this creature many times. And then there was also the fact that my cinematographer and I kept hearing rocks being thrown into the creek that ran directly behind Doyle and Lyle. So while we're down there filming, something was hitting the water behind them, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like berries or you know, fish or tadpole or anything like that. It was pretty loud kerthunks hitting the water. So there were unusual things going on down there. But I mean, I kind of agree with you. It isn't extremely unusual, but it was unusual enough that I thought, you know what, like every single time we do a Q&A after we finish a movie, the first question people ask us is, did anything happen to you guys while you were there filming? And I thought, instead of answering that question, we'll actually just put it in the movie and let people, you know, make up their own minds as far as that goes. But I mean, I kind of agree with you. It's not so strange that it sounds like you're hearing 100% Bigfoot screaming at you. But it was curious enough that I think it's worth, you know, examining.
Well, at least weirder than stick structures, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, I guess I could have just stuck 100 photos of, like, sticks falling over on top of each other in the movie. You know, like, while we were down there filming, we discovered numerous Bigfoot teepees.
I actually want to see someone do a full-fledged mockumentary and just, like, find every little thing in the forest that they can that they claim it to be evidence of Bigfoot, you know.
Just look on YouTube.
That's yeah, really.
What this trail of ants is fleeing a Bigfoot. Look at it. Yeah.
How come you didn't include the stuff you experienced in the documentary?
Well, the stuff that happened with us wasn't on camera. That was just kind of us, you know, like in that place that stuff was happening to me and the cinematographer. I didn't include it because it would have taken away from the story as it was for us to suddenly be like, you know, like while we were there, we also saw a rock thrown into the creek and stuff, you know, like things like that. I don't know. Maybe I overthink things like that, but just, I'm just very cautious of inserting myself into these stories. For me, the stories are about either the people that experienced, you know, those events, or they're about people that live in that town or connected to those stories who are telling those stories. I don't need to be all of a sudden appearing on camera, you know, like I'm Bobo or something. It's just that kind of thing doesn't really interest me.
No, I think that's wise. I mean, like with my books, I never put, well, not never, but I hesitate to put myself into the, you know, any sort of first person stuff, because I feel like it sort of dilutes the product in general, you know. And I think that if people want to approach you and ask you about these things, that's a whole different thing. But, you know, to put that alongside of some other, it makes you seem less impartial, I guess, is sort of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, you have to be really careful about it, because it's in a way, for me, it can call things into question if all of a sudden you're appearing within that story. And now, having said that, if it was a natural part of the story, if I was investigating a film, you know, like we were doing a film, and I felt like the best way for us to tell this story was for me to actually appear on camera, I guess the best example I can think of is Mothman. I'm not going to be in Mothman, but initially I had considered telling the Mothman story from my point of view, similar to what we did with Boggy, because of the fact that I'm so confused by the Mothman story, I guess is the word. But like, you know, like the story would have been more of me trying to figure out the truth behind the Mothman story for myself, and the viewers would have been going on that ride with me. But at the same time, like, I'm not telling that story because the idea of sticking myself in a Mothman movie, that's just not, I don't know, maybe it's just my own personal taste, is I don't really care to see people who weren't involved in those, you know, sightings or that story in the movie. Now, Lyle fit naturally into Boggy Creek, in my opinion, because of the fact that he was so tied to the stories. He basically became an unofficial member of that town, you know, when he started investigating this. If you go to Falk with Lyle, everyone there knows him and everyone likes him and they'll talk to him and they have no problem talking to him. So for Lyle, I felt like it was a little more natural to have him in the movie. And also, like, just that storytelling device really helped us condense, again, like, it just helped us condense all that history.
Did you bring the sound to anyone who maybe could identify it by any chance?
No, I did not. No. I know a guy, in the Olympic Project who I can do that and who I probably need to do that at some point. I think my biggest problem is, like, last year we actually edited and put out, released two movies, and then there was, you know, there was a Kickstarter campaign and all that. So it's like, this is what I was talking about. Like, there's two Seths here, because there's, like, the filmmaker, and then there's the Seth who should have sent that audio to someone to analyze at some point. But, like, I mean, I'll probably do that, you know, tomorrow or something, because it's one of those things where all I have to do is put it in a Dropbox folder and send it to someone, you know, like, it takes 5 seconds, but it's one of those things that I just have not done.
Yeah, no, I understand. Is there, speaking of that though, is there anything else you wish you could have included in this movie that you didn't get to, or anything else you wish you could have done with it?
There's a lot. Yeah, this movie could have been 2 hours, but it's like one of those things where I'm always keenly aware of the fact that our audience is not just Bigfoot fans or paranormal people in general. Like, I think the bulk of our audience, the people that we see at our screenings and the people that come out to Minerva Monster Day when we put that on here, they tend to be a general audience who are kind of vaguely aware or interested in the subject of Bigfoot and appreciate the fact that we approach it the way we do. So I'm always trying to keep, you know, our runtime to a point where I don't feel like we're going to inundate someone with information. But with Boggy Creek, there's a lot more to the Terry Sutton sequence that I wish we had included in the film. And honestly, in retrospect, I don't know why it cut some of that stuff out. There's just little. It's honestly, it's nothing that anyone else would notice, but it's like a piece of that story that I wish was still in there. Terry talked about running back to his home and telling his dad the story. And in our movie, what we did is, like, we go from Terry kind of talking about how he saw the creature right into his dad talking about how Terry ran home. And I just wish those two had cut together a little better. There's a couple H.L. Phillips sequences I wish I had included, and I might, you know, include when we do that director's cut. And, I mean, anytime we finish one of these, I wish we could have talked to more people. You know, like, that's always I wish there were more people still alive for us to talk to. I found out after the movie came out that the Fords are actually, the Ford family is still actually kind of in the area. And I found out that some of them have passed away. So I was at least able to get some closure on what happened to the Fords, because I had wondered about it. They had never spoken publicly about their experiences after the incident had happened. They moved away from Falk like a week later, and never went back and never talked to anyone about what had happened. And there's little things like that I always wish we could have fleshed out a little better. And in most of the time, it's not that, you know, it's not a storytelling decision. It's just a fact of those people either are dead or they don't want anything to do with the story, so we can't have them actually telling their own side of it.
Yeah, it's almost sort of in regards to what you're saying about wishing things were in there that didn't make the cut or whatever. I said this somewhere recently. It might have been on here. It might have been on Greg's show on Radio Mysterioso, but someone said it a long time ago, and I think in terms of whenever you're producing art in general, this is the case. Films aren't released, they escape, you know.
Yeah. No, that's totally true. And like, some of the, with Boggy, we we have this deadline of November 11th, and I tend to give us deadlines because if we don't have them, I feel like we're lazy and we don't work as hard as we should.
Or you'll never finish.
Right, right. And so with this one, I had given us this deadline of November 11th, and some of that was also inspired by the fact that I found out my wife was pregnant, so I knew we were having a kid, and you know, like I'm like, okay, well, I got to get this movie done so I can start working toward this, so I can have this done before the baby comes. So like, you're always juggling work and life, but there's a lot more to the Boggy story. Like I said to Lyle recently, like it's a thing where we could easily revisit Boggy Creek Monster as a film again at some point. Now, I don't think it would be a direct sequel. I don't think it would be Boggy Creek Monster 2, and you would track with Lyle as he goes. I think it would be a little different in that way, but there's definitely enough stories there that you could tell multiple movies. But I think the same thing about Minerva and Whitehall. You know, like I think both of those movies need to be, not just should be, but need to be revisited at some point. And I hope it's us that does it.
Whatever you end up doing, if you end up revisiting Boggy Creek, promise me you'll keep the original naming convention, which was like, wasn't it like Boggy Creek and then something and then Boggy Creek 2? I think it's Boggy Creek 3.
Yeah, Return to Boggy Creek is Boggy Creek 2, and then it's Boggy Creek 2, and the legend continues, which is technically Boggy Creek 3. Huh. Yeah, it's the weirdest series.
All right. Well, where can people get this?
It's available on Amazon Instant Video and Vimeo On Demand and through shop.smalltownmonsters.com. We sell it on DVD, and then we've got like the box set that includes all three of our movies, and we've got other movies and T-shirts. And
what are the movies?
Minerva Monster and Beast of Whitehall.
Oh, okay. When you said other movies, I thought there was more than the three.
No, I wish. I seriously, like, I'd love to keep doing this. I mean, this is something that, you know, like, I hope I can do. I've got my sights set on finishing out 2017 with hopefully two more movies. I mean, we started production on Mothman back in September, technically, but we were filming last week and we're filming next week, so...
Were you at the Mothman Festival?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was down there. Actually, that's when we started shooting.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. We filmed around the festival because I knew I wanted to have a little bit of footage from the festival in the film. And then I got to shoot like the sun setting over the Ohio River with the Memorial Bridge in the foreground, stuff like that. So yeah, we've been working on that for a while.
And when are you hoping to have that? What's your deadline for that one?
I didn't set the deadline yet, but by the time we're launching the Kickstarter to fund it on February 2nd, and by the time we launch that, I'm hoping to have a definitive release date because we should be done filming in the next 2 weeks. So once we do that, I can sit down, look at the footage, and say, okay, I think I can realistically, you know, complete this in X amount of time, and then it becomes a complete chaotic scramble to do that.
All right. Okay. So maybe by summer?
It should be spring. I mean, we've put out like the posters and all that stuff, and everything says spring. I'm just not 100% sure yet on when spring is.
Well, get pushed back all the time.
Yeah.
And seasons seem to change.
Right, right.
You know, sometimes it gets warm early. Sometimes it doesn't get warm till like June.
Yeah. Well, in Ohio, we can have blizzards in the middle of May. So
we've had that here in upstate New York as well.
Yeah.
And other times it's warm in March. You're in the 60s and 70s. Sometimes in January and February at times.
It was 60. It was 60 degrees here. 67 degrees here this past Monday.
Oh wow! Wow, that's more than we got.
I got the window open right now, guys. So.
Well, you're in Georgia. You are in Georgia.
Yeah, right? I know. Yeah. I know.
Well, it's different. That's the downside, Georgia.
But you know, if it snows in Georgia, if it's just flakes fall, people panic. Whereas up here, at least we can deal with it.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, and to be fair, like the infrastructure for if anything goes wrong is not prepared. You know that. I think like some of these school districts own like one snowplow, if that. So you know,
exactly
the trade off.
All right. So, again, the movie is The Boggy Creek Monster, not to be confused with any other iterations of this. And right. Where else? So, people, smalltownmonsters.com is the best place people can find you online.
Yeah, shop.smalltownmonsters.com. We update the Facebook page way more than I update that website. The website is in dire need of being updated, and I've got like this brand new website, but I'm having trouble getting it uploaded. So once that gets up, I will be much more adamant about people visiting the website. But for now, I'm always telling people to just stick to Facebook.
All right. Well, I thank you, Seth.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much, Seth. Great work on everything. Top-notch productions. Everybody go out and check it out, for sure.
Absolutely. All right, and as I said at the beginning, for patrons, watch your feed, because for a couple of days it'll be available for you to watch The Boggy Creek Monster for free, thanks to Seth. To become a patron, you can go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. It's only $3 a month. It helps us out greatly, and lots of cool stuff to come in 2017. And I think since we talked so much about Lyle Blackburn being a part of this project, we're going to end with a song from his band Ghoul Town, which is back together and recording. So that makes me pretty happy. I like this band. And we're going to hear Walking Through the Desert from Lyle and Ghoul Town.